Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga. Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga. Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to this, the 84th of the Cthulhu Podcast. I'm FNH. We'll be starting with the next part of Through the Brazilian Wilderness, then a 1924 recording, and then on to part two of our new Lovecraftian epic. Oh, and a blooper to follow. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 45. In spite of the weather, Cherry and Miller, whom, together with Father Sam and Zig, we had found awaiting us, made good collections of birds and mammals. Among the latter were opossums and mice that were new to them. The birds included various forms so unlike our home birds that the enumeration of their names would mean nothing. One of the most interesting was a large black and white woodpecker, the white predominating in the plumage. Several of these woodpeckers were usually found together. They were showy, noisy, and restless, and perched on twigs in ordinary bird fashion, at least as often as they clung to the trunks in orthodox woodpecker style. The prettiest bird was a tiny manakin, coal black, with a red and orange head. On February 2nd the rain let up, although the sky remained overcast and there were occasional showers. I walked off with my rifle for a couple of leagues. At that distance, from a slight hillock, the mist columns of the falls were conspicuous in the landscape. The only mammal I saw on the walk was a rather hairy armadillo with a flexible tail, which I picked up and brought back to Miller. It showed none of the speed of the nine-banded armadillos we met on our jaguar hunt. Judging by its actions as it trotted about before it saw me, it must be diurnal in habit. It was new to the collection. I spent much of the afternoon by the waterfall. Under the overcast sky, the great cataract lost the deep green and fleecy white of the sunlit falling waters. Instead, it showed opaline hues and tints of topaz and amethyst. At all times and under all lights, it was majestic and beautiful. Colonel Rondon had given the Indians various presents, those for the women including calico prints, and what they especially prized, bottles of scented oil from Paris for their hair. The men held a dance in the late afternoon. For this occasion, most, but not all, of them cast aside their civilized clothing, and appeared as doubtless they would all have appeared had none but themselves been present. They were absolutely naked, except for a beaded string around the waist. Most of them were spotted and dashed with red paint, and on one leg wore anklets which rattled. A number carried pipes through which they blew a kind of deep, stifled whistle in time to the dancing. One of them had this pipe leading into a huge gourd, which gave out a hollow, moaning boom. Many wore two red or green or yellow macaw feathers in their hair, and one had a macaw feather stuck transversely through the septum of his nose. They circled slowly round and round, chanting and stamping their feet, while the anklet rattles clattered and the pipes droned. They advanced to the wall of one of the houses, again and again chanting and bowing before it. I was told this was a demand for drink. They entered one house and danced in a ring round the cooking fire in the middle of the earth floor. I was told that they were reciting the deeds of mighty hunters, and describing how they brought in the game. They drank freely from gourds and pannikins of a fermented drink made from mandioc, which was brought out to them. During the first part of the dance, the women remained in the houses, and all the doors and windows were shut, and blankets hung to prevent the possibility of seeing out. But during the second part, all the women and girls came out and looked on. They were themselves to have danced when the men had finished, but were overcome with shyness at the thought of dancing with so many strangers looking on. The children played about with unconcern throughout the ceremony, one of them throwing high in the air and again catching in his hands a loaded feather, a kind of shuttlecock. In the evening, the growing moon shone through the cloud rack. Anything approaching fair weather always put our men in good spirits, and the muleteers squatted in a circle by a fire near a pile of packs and listened to a long, monotonously and rather mournfully chanted song about a dance and a love affair. We ourselves worked busily with our photographs and our writing. There was so much humidity in the air that everything grew damp and stayed damp, and mould gathered quickly. At this season, it is a country in which writing, taking photographs, and preparing specimen are all works of difficulty, at least so far as concerns preserving and sending home the results of the labour, and a man's clothing is never really dry. From here, Father Zahm returned to Tapira Rowan, accompanied by Sig. Chapter 7. With a Mule Train Across the Namekara Land. From this point on, we were to enter a still wilder region, the land of naked Namekaras. On February 3rd, the weather cleared, and we started with the mule train and two ox carts. Fiella and Lieutenant Luriado stayed at Utiarity to take canoes to go down the Papagayo, which had not been descended by any scientific party, and perhaps by no one. They were then to descend the Juriana and the Tapajos, thereby performing a necessary part of the work of the expedition. Our remaining party consisted of Colonel Rondon, Lieutenant Lyra, the Doctor, Oliveira, Cherry, Miller, Kermit, and myself. On the Juriana we expected to meet the pack ox train with Captain Amilcar and Lieutenant Mello. The other Brazilian members of the party had returned. We had now begun the difficult part of the expedition. The pium flies were becoming a pest. There was much fever and beriberi in the country we were entering. The feed for the animals was poor. The rains had made the trail slippery and difficult, and many, both of the mules and the oxen, were already weak, and some had to be abandoned. We left the canoe, the motor, and the gasoline. We had hoped to try them on the Amazonian rivers, but we were obliged to cut down everything that was not absolutely indispensable. Before leaving, we prepared the shipment back to the museum of some of the bigger skins, and also some of the weapons and utensils of the Indians which Kermit had collected. These included woven fillets, and fillets made of macaw feathers for use in the dances. Woven belts, a gourd in which a sacred drink is offered to the god Enaori. Wickerwork baskets, flutes or pipes, anklet rattles, hammocks, a belt of the kind used by the women in carrying the babies with the weaving frame. All of these were Parasis articles. He also secured from the Namekaras wickerwork baskets of a different type and bows and arrows. The bows were 7 feet long and the arrows 5 feet. There were blunt-headed arrows for birds, arrows with long sharp wooden blades for tapir, deer, and other mammals, and the poisoned war arrows with sharp barbs, poison-coated and bound on by fine thongs, and a long hollow wooden gourd to slip over the entire point to protect it until it came to the time for use. When people talk glibly of idle savages, they ignore the immense labour entertained by many of their industries and the really extraordinary amount of work they accomplish by the skilful use of their primitive and ineffective tools. Our music for this week is an instrumental piece from 1924 by the Benson Orchestra of Chicago. They're playing That's Georgia. Thank you. on to the main feature. At the Mountains of Madness, Chapter 2. Popular imagination, I judge, responded actively to our wireless bulletins of lakes start northwestward into the regions never trod by human foot or penetrated by human imagination, though we did not mention his wild hopes of revolutionizing the entire sciences of biology and geology. His preliminary sledging and boring journey of January 11th to 18th with Parbody and five others, marred by the loss of two dogs in an upset when crossing one of the great pressure ridges in the ice, had brought up more and more of the Acheyan slate, and even I was interested by the singular profusion of evident fossil markings in that unbelievably ancient stratum. These markings, however, were of very primitive life forms, involving no great paradox except that any life form should occur in rock as definitely Precambrian as this seemed to be. Hence I still failed to see the good sense of Lake's demand for all four planes, many men, and the whole of the expedition's mechanical apparatus. I did not in the end veto the plan, though I decided not to accompany the northwestward party despite Lake's plea for my geological advice. While they were gone, I would remain at the base with Parbody and five men and work out final plans for the eastward shift. In preparation for this transfer, one of the planes had begun to move up a good gasoline supply from McMurdo Sound, but this could wait temporarily. I kept with me one sledge and nine dogs, since it is unwise to be at any time without possible transportation in an utterly tenantless world of eon-long death. Lake's sub-expedition into the unknown, as everyone will recall, sent out its own reports from the shortwave transmitters on the planes, these being simultaneously picked up by our apparatus at the southern base and by the Arkham at McMurdo Sound, whence they were relayed to the outside world on wavelengths of up to 50 metres. The start was made January 22nd at 4 a.m, and the first wireless message we received came only 2 hours later, when Lake spoke of descending and starting a small-scale ice melting and bore at a point some 300 miles away from us. 6 hours after that, a second and very excited message told of the frantic, beaver-like work whereby a shallow shaft had been sunk and blasted, culminating in the discovery of slate fragments with several markings approximately like the one which had caused the original puzzlement. 3 hours later, a brief bulletin announced the resumption of the flight in the teeth of a raw and piercing gale, and when I dispatched a message of protest against further hazards, Lake replied curtly that his new specimens made any hazard worth taking. I saw that his excitement had reached the point of mutiny, and that I could do nothing to check this headlong risk of the whole expedition's success, but it was appalling to think of his plunging deeper and deeper into that treacherous and sinister white immensity of tempests and unfathomed mysteries which stretched off to the 1,500 miles of the half-known, half-suspected coastline of Queen Mary and Knoxlands. Then, in about an hour and a half more, came that doubly excited message from Lake's moving plane, which almost reversed my sentiments and made me wish I had accompanied the party. 10:05 p.m. on the wing. After snowstorm, have spied mountain range ahead, higher than any hitherto seen. May equal Himalayas, allowing for height of plateau. Probable latitude, 76 degrees 15 minutes. Longitude, 113 degrees 10 minutes east. Reaches far as can see right and left. Suspicion of two smoking cones. All peaks black and bare of snow. Gale blowing off them impedes navigation. After that, Parbody, the men and I hung breathlessly over the receiver. Thought of this titanic mountain rampart 700 miles away inflamed our deepest sense of adventure, and we rejoiced that our expedition, if not ourselves personally, had been its discoverers. In half an hour, Lake called us again. Moulton's plane forced down on plateau in foothills, but nobody hurt and perhaps can repair. Shall transfer essentials to other three for return and further moves if necessary, but no more heavy plane travel needed just now. Mountains surpass anything in imagination, and going up scouting in Carroll's plane with all weight out. You can't imagine anything like this. Highest peaks must go over 35,000 feet. Everest out of the running. Atwood to work out height with theodolite while Carroll and I go up. Probably wrong about cones, for formations look stratified. Possibly Precambrian slate with other strata mixed in. queer skyline effects, regular sections of cubes clinging to the highest peaks, whole thing marvellously in red and gold light of low sun, like land of mystery in a dream, or gateway to forbidden world of untrodden wonder. Wish you were here to study. Though it was technically sleeping time, not one of us listeners thought for a moment of retiring. It must have been a good deal the same at McMurdo Sound, where the supply cache and the Arkham were also getting the messages, for Captain Douglas gave out a call congratulating everybody on the important find, and Sherman, the cache operator, seconded his sentiments. We were sorry, of course, about the damaged aeroplane, but hoped it could be easily mended. Then at 11 p.m, another call came from Lake. Up with Carol over highest foothills. Don't dare try really tall peaks in present weather, but shall later. Frightful work climbing, and hard going at this altitude, but worth it. Great range fairly solid, hence can't get any glimpses beyond. Main summits exceed Himalayas, and very queer. Range looks like Precambrian slate with plain signs of many other upheaved strata. Was wrong about volcanism. Goes further in either direction than we can see. Swept clear of snow above 21,000 feet. Odd formations on slopes of highest mountains. Great low square blocks with exactly vertical sides and rectangular lines of low vertical ramparts. Like the old Asian castles clinging to steep mountains in Rocher's paintings. Impressive from distance. Flew close to some, and Carol thought they were formed of smaller separate pieces, but that is probably weathering. Most edges crumbled and rounded off, as if exposed to storms and climate changes for millions of years. Parts, especially the upper parts, seem to be of lighter coloured rock than any visible strata on the slopes proper, hence the evidently crystalline origin. Close flying shows many cave mouths, some unusually regular in outline, square or semicircular. You must come and investigate. Think I saw ramparts squarely on top of one peak. Height seems about 30,000 to 35,000 feet. Am up to 21,500 myself, in devilish gnawing cold. Wind whistles and pipes through passes and in and out of caves, but no flying danger so far. From then on, for another half hour, Lake kept up a running fire of comment and expressed his intention of climbing some of these peaks on foot. I replied that I would join him as soon as I could send a plane, and that Parbody and I would work out the best gasoline plan, just where and how to concentrate our supply in view of the expedition's altered character. Obviously, Lake's boring operations, as well as his aeroplane activities, would require a great deal for the new base which he planned to establish at the foot of the mountains, and it was possible that the eastward flight might not be made after all. In connection with this business, I called Captain Douglas and asked him to get as much as possible out of the ships and up to the barrier with the single dog team we had left there. A direct route across the unknown region between Lake and McMurdo Sound was what we really ought to establish. Lake called me later to say that he had decided to let the camp stay where Moulton's plane had been forced down and where repairs had already progressed somewhat. The ice sheet was very thin, with dark ground here and there visible, and he would sink some borings and blasts at that very point before making any sledge trips or climbing expeditions. He spoke of the ineffable majesty of the whole scene, and the queer state of his sensations at being in the lee of vast silent pinnacles whose ranks shot up like a wall reaching the sky at the world's rim. Atwood's theodolite observations had placed the height of the five tallest peaks at from 30,000 to 34,000 feet. The windswept nature of the terrain clearly disturbed Lake, for it argued the occasional existence of prodigious gales, violent beyond anything we had so far encountered. His camp lay a little more than 5 miles from where the higher foothills rose abruptly. I could almost trace a note of subconscious alarm in his words, flashed across the glacial void of 700 miles, as he urged that we all hasten with the matter and get the strange new region disposed of as soon as possible. He was about to rest now, after a continuous day's work of almost unparalleled speed, strenuousness, and results. In the morning, I had a three-cornered wireless talk with Lake and Captain Douglas at their widely separated bases. It was agreed that one of Lake's planes would come to my base for Parbody, the five men and myself, as well as for all the fuel it could carry. The rest of the fuel question, depending on our decision about an easterly trip, could wait for a few days, since Lake had enough for immediate camp heat and borings. Eventually, the old southern base ought to be restocked, but if we postponed the easterly trip, we would not use it till the next summer, and meanwhile, Lake must send a plane to explore a direct route between his new mountains and McMurdo Sound. Parbody and I prepared to close our base for a short or long period as the case might be. If we wintered in the Antarctic, we would probably fly straight from Lake's base to the Arkham without returning to this spot. Some of our conical tents had already been reinforced by blocks of hard snow, and now we decided to complete the job of making a permanent village. Owing to a very liberal tent supply, Lake had with him all that his base would need, even after our arrival. I wirelessed that Parbody and I would be ready for the northwestward move after one day's work and one night's rest. Our labours, however, were not very steady after 4 p.m. For about that time, Lake began sending in the most extraordinary and excited messages. His working day had started unprecipitously, since an aeroplane survey of the nearly exposed rock surfaces showed an entire absence of those Archean and primordial strata for which he was looking, and which formed so great a part of the colossal peaks that loomed up at a tantalizing distance from the camp. Most of the rocks glimpsed were apparently Jurassic, or Kamachian sandstones and Permian and Triassic schists, and now and then a glossy black outcropping, suggesting a hard and salty coal. This rather discouraged Lake, whose plans all hinged on unearthing specimens more than 500 million years older. It was clear to him that in order to recover the Archean slate vein in which he had found the odd markings, he would have to make a long sledge trip from those foothills to the steep slopes of the gigantic mountains themselves. He had resolved nevertheless to do some local boring as part of the expedition's general program. Hence he set up the drill and put 5 men to work with it while the rest finished settling the camp and repairing the damaged aeroplane. The softest visible rock, a sandstone about a quarter of a mile from the camp, had been chosen for the first sampling, and the drill made excellent progress without much supplementary blasting. It was about 3 hours afterward, following the first really heavy blast of the operation, that the shouting of the drill crew was heard, and that young Gedney, an acting foreman, rushed into the camp with the startling news. They had struck a cave. Early in the boring, the sandstone had given place to a vein of Comachian limestone full of minute fossil cephalopods, corals, echini, and spirifera, and with occasional suggestions of siliceous sponges and marine vertebrae bones. The latter probably teleocar, sharks, and ganoids. This in itself was important enough as affording the first vertebrae fossils the expedition had yet secured. But when, shortly afterward, the drill head dropped through the stratum into apparent vacancy, a wholly new and doubly intense wave of excitement spread amongst the excavators. A good-sized blast had laid open the subterranean secret, and now, through a jagged aperture perhaps 5 feet across and 3 feet thick, there yawned before the avid searchers a section of shallow limestone hollowing worn more than 50 million years ago by the trickling groundwaters of a bygone tropic world. The hollowed layer was not more than 7 or 8 feet deep, but extended off indefinitely in all directions, and had a fresh, slightly moving air, which suggested its membership with an extensive subterranean system. Its roof and floor were abundantly equipped with large stalactites and stalagmites, some of which met in columnar form. But important above all else was the vast deposit of shells and bones which in places nearly choked the passage, washed down from some unknown jungles of Mesozoic tree ferns and fungi, and forests of tertiary cycads, fan palms, and primitive angiosperms. This osseous medley contained representatives of more Cretaceous, Eocene, and other animal species than the greatest paleontologist could have counted or classified in a year. Mollusks, crustacean armor, fishes, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and early mammals, great and small, known and unknown. No wonder Gedney ran back to the camp shouting, and no wonder everyone else dropped work and rushed headlong through the biting cold to see where the tall derrick marked a newfound gateway to secrets of inner earth and vanished eons. When Lake had satisfied the first keen edge of his curiosity, he scribbled a message in his notebook and had young Moulton run back to the camp to dispatch it by wireless. This was my first word of the discovery, and it told of the identification of early shells, bones of ganoids and placoderms. there were remnants of labyrinthodonts and thecodonts, great mesiosaur skull fragments, dinosaur vertebrae and armor plates, pterodactyl teeth and wing bones, Archaeoturk's debris, Miocene shark's teeth, primitive bird skulls, and other bones of archaic mammals such as paleotheres, xiphodons, eohippi, iridons, and titanotheres. There was nothing as recent as a mastodon, elephant, true camel, deer, or bovine animal. Hence Lake concluded that the last deposits had occurred during the Oligocene age, and that the hollowed stratum had lain in its present dried, dead, and inaccessible state for at least 30 million years. On the other hand, the prevalence of very early life forms was singular in the highest degree. Though the limestone formation was, on the evidence of such typically embedded fossils as ventricolites, positively and unmistakably Comanchean, and not a particle earlier, the free fragments in the hollow space included a surprising proportion from organisms hitherto considered as peculiar to far older periods. Even rudimentary fishes, mollusks, and corals as remote as Silurian and Ordovician. The inevitable inference was that in this part of the world there had been a remarkable and unique degree of continuity between the life of over 300 million years ago and that of only 30 million years ago. How far this continuity had extended beyond the Oligocene age, when the cavern was closed, was of course past all speculation. In any event, the coming of the frightful ice in the Pliocene some 500,000 years ago, a mere yesterday as compared with the age of this cavity, must have put an end to any of the primal forms which had locally managed to outlive their common terms. Lake was not content to let his first message stand, but had another bulletin written and dispatched across the snow to the camp before Moulton could get back. After that, Moulton stayed at the wireless in one of the planes, transmitting to me and to the Arkham for relaying to the outside world the frequent postscripts which Lake sent to him by a series of messengers. Those who followed the newspapers will remember the excitement created among men of science by that afternoon's reports, reports which have finally led, after all these years, to the organisation of that very Starkweather Moor expedition which I am so anxious to dissuade from its purposes. I'd better give the messages literally, as Lake sent them, and as our base operator McTeesh translated them from the pencil shorthand. Fowler makes discovery of highest importance in sandstone and limestone fragments from blasts. Several distinct triangular striated prints like those in Archean slate, proving that source survived from over 600 million years ago to Comanchean times without more than moderate morphological changes and decrease in average size. Comanchean prints apparently more primitive or decadent, if anything, than older ones. Emphasize importance of discovery in press will mean to biology what Einstein has meant to mathematics and physics. Joins up with my previous work and amplifies conclusions. Later, examining certain skeletal fragments of large land and marine saurians and primitive mammals, find singular local wounds or injuries to bony structure not attributable to any known predatory or carnivorous animal of any period, of two sorts, straight, penetrant bores, and apparently hacking incisions. One or two cases of cleanly severed bones. Not many specimens affected. Am sending to camp for electric torches, will extend search area underground by hacking away stalactites. Still later, have found peculiar soapstone fragment about 6 inches across and 1.5 inches thick, wholly unlike any visible local formation. Greenish, but no evidence is to place its period. Has curious smoothness and regularity. Shaped like 5-pointed star with tips broken off, and signs of other cleavage at inward angles and in centre of surface. Small, smooth depression in centre of unbroken surface. Arouses much curiosity as to source and weathering. Probably some freak of water action. Carroll, with magnifier, thinks he can make out additional markings of geologic significance. Groups of tiny dots in regular patterns. Dogs growing uneasy as we work, and seem to hate this soapstone. Must see if it has any peculiar odour. We'll report again when Mills gets back with light and we start on underground area. 10:15 p.m. Important discovery. Orendorff and Watkins, working wholly underground at 9:45 with light, found monstrous barrel-shaped fossil of wholly unknown nature. Probably vegetable, unless overgrown specimen of unknown marine radiata. Tissue evidently preserved by mineral salts. Tough as leather, but astonishing flexibility retained in places. Marks of broken-off parts at ends and around the sides. 6 feet end-to-end, 3 5/10 feet central diameter, tapering to 1 foot at each end. Like a barrel, with 5 bulging ridges in place of staves. Lateral breakages, as of thinnish stalks, are at equator in middle of these ridges. In furrows between ridges are curious growths, combs or wings, that fold up and spread out like fans. All greatly damaged but one, which gives an almost 7 foot wing spread. Arrangement reminds one of certain monsters of primal myth, especially fabled elder things in the Necronomicon. Their wings seem to be membranous, stretched on frame of glandular tubing. Apparent minute orifices in frame tubing at wingtips, ends of body shriveled, giving no clue to interior or to what has been broken off there. Must dissect when we get back to camp. Can't decide whether vegetable or animal. Many features, obviously of almost incredible primitiveness, have set all hands to cutting stalactites and looking for further specimens. Additional scarred bones found, but these must wait. Having trouble with the dogs. They can't endure the new specimen and would probably tear it to pieces if we didn't keep it at a distance from them. 11:30 p.m. Attention, Dyer, Parbody, Douglas. Matter of highest, I might say transcendent, importance. Arkham must relay to Kingsport head station at once. Strange barrel growth is the Archaean thing that left prints in rocks. Mills, Baudreau, and Fowler discover cluster of 13 more at underground point 40 feet from aperture, mixed with curiously rounded and configured soapstone fragments smaller than the one previously found, star-shaped, but no marks of breakage except at some of the points. Of organic specimens, 8 apparently perfect, with all appendages, have brought all to the surface, leading off dogs to distance. They cannot stand the things. Give close attention to description and repeat back for accuracy. Papers must get this right. Objects are 8 feet long all over. 6 foot, 5 ridged barrel, torso 3 5/10 feet central diameter, 1 foot end diameters. Dark grey. Flexible and infinitely tough. 7 foot membranous wings of same colour, found folded, spread out of furrows between ridges. Wing framework, tubular or glandular, of lighter grey, with orifices at wingtips. Wingtips have serrated edge. Around equator, one at central apex of each of the 5 vertical stave-like ridges, are 5 systems of light grey flexible arms or tentacles found tightly folded to torso, but expansible to maximum length of over 3 feet. Like arms of primitive crinoid. Single stalks, 3 inches diameter, branch out after 6 inches into 5 substalks, each of which branches after 8 inches into small, tapering tentacles or tendrils, giving each stalk a total of 25 tentacles. At top of the torso, blunt bulbous neck of lighter grey, with gill-like suggestions, holds yellowish 5-pointed starfish-shaped apparent head covered with 3-inch wiry cilia of various prismatic colours. Head. Thick and puffy, about 2 feet point to point, with 3-inch flexible yellowish tubes projecting from each point. Stilt in exact centre of top, probably breathing aperture. At end of each tube is spherical expansion where yellowish membrane rolls back on handling to reveal glassy red irised globe, evidently an eye. 5 slightly longer reddish tubes start from inner angles of starfish-shaped head and end in sac-like swellings of same colour which upon pressure open to bell-shaped orifices 2 inches maximum diameter and lined with sharp white tooth-like projections, probably mouths. All these tubes, cilia, and points of starfish head found folded tightly down. tubes and points clinging to Bulba's neck and torso. Flexibility, surprising despite vast toughness. At bottom of torso, rough but dissimilarly functioning counterparts of head arrangement exist. Bulbous, light grey pseudo-neck, without gill suggestions, holds greenish five-pointed starfish arrangement. Tough muscular arms, 4 feet long, and tapering from 7 inches diameter at base to about 2 5/10 at point. To each point is attached small end of a greenish, five-veined, membranous triangle, 8 inches long and 6 wide at farther end. This is the paddle, fin, or pseudo-foot, which has made prints in rocks from 1,000 million to 50 or 60 million years old. From inner angles of starfish arrangement project 2-foot reddish tubes, tapering from 3 inches diameter at base to 1 at tip. Orifices at tips. All these parts infinitely tough and leathery, but extremely flexible. 4-foot arms with paddles undoubtedly used for locomotion of some sort, marine or otherwise. When moved, display suggestions of exaggerated muscularity. As found, all these projections tightly folded over pseudo-neck and end of torso, corresponding to projections at other end. Cannot yet assign positively to animal or vegetable kingdom, but odds now favour animal. Probably represents incredible advanced evolution of radiata, without loss of certain primitive features. Echinoderm resemblances unmistakable, despite local contradictory evidences. Wing structure puzzles, in view of probable marine habitat, but may have use in water navigation. Symmetry is curiously vegetable-like, suggesting vegetables' essential up-and-down structure rather than animals' fore and aft structure. Fabulously early date of evolution, preceding even simplest Archaean protozoa hitherto known, baffles all conjecture as to origin. Complete specimens have such uncanny resemblance to certain creatures of primal myth that suggestion of ancient existence outside of Antarctic becomes inevitable. Dyer and Parbody have read Necronomicon and seen Clark Ashton Smith's nightmare paintings based on text and will understand when I speak of elder things supposed to have created all life on Earth as jest or mistake. Students have always thought conception formed from morbid imagination, treatment of very ancient tropical radiata. Also, like prehistoric folklore things, Wilmarth has spoken of Cthulhu cult appendages, etc. Vast field of study opened. Deposits probably of late Cretaceous or early Eocene period, judging from associated specimens. Massive stalagmites deposited above them, hard work hewing out, but toughness prevented damage. State of preservation, miraculous, evidently owing to limestone action. No more found so far, but will resume search later. Job now to get 14 huge specimens to camp without dogs, which bark furiously and can't be trusted near them. With 9 men, 3 left to guard the dogs, we ought to manage the 3 sledges fairly well, though wind is bad. Must establish plain communication with McMurdo Sound and begin shipping material. But I've got to dissect one of these things before we take any rest. Wish I had a real laboratory here. Dyer better kick himself for having tried to stop my westward trip. First the world's greatest mountains, and then this. If this last isn't the high spot of the expedition, I don't know what is. We're made, scientifically. Congrats, Parbody, on the drill that opened up the cave. Now will Arkham please repeat description? The sensations of Parbody and myself at receipt of this report were almost beyond description, nor were our companions much behind us in enthusiasm. McTighe, who had hastily translated a few high spots as they came from the droning receiving set, wrote out the entire message from his shorthand version as soon as Lake's operator signed off. All appreciated the epoch-making significance of the discovery, and I sent Lake congratulations as soon as the Arkham's operator had repeated back the descriptive parts as requested, and my example was followed by Sherman from his station at McMurdo Sound Supply Cache, as well as by Captain Douglas of the Arkham. Later, as head of the expedition, I added some remarks to be relayed through the Arkham to the outside world. Of course, rest was an absurd thought amidst this excitement, and my only wish was to get to Lake's camp as quickly as I could. It disappointed me when he sent word that a rising mountain gale had made early aerial travel impossible. But within an hour and a half, interest again rose to banish disappointment. Lake, sending more messages, told of the completely successful transportation of the 14 great specimens to the camp. It had been a hard pull, for the things were surprisingly heavy, but 9 men had accomplished it very neatly. Now some of the party were hurriedly building a snow corral at a safe distance from the camp, to which the dogs could be brought for greater convenience in feeding. The specimens were laid out on the hard snow near the camp, save for one on which Lake was making crude attempts at dissection. This dissection seemed to be a greater task than had been expected, for despite the heat of a gasoline stove in the newly raised laboratory tent, the deceptively flexible tissues of the chosen specimen, a powerful and intact one, lost nothing of their more than leathery toughness. Lake was puzzled as to how he might make the requisite incisions without violence destructive enough to upset all the structural niceties he was looking for. He had, it is true, 7 more perfect specimens, but there were too few to use up recklessly unless the cave might yield later an unlimited supply. Accordingly, he removed the specimen and dragged in one which, though having the remnants of the starfish arrangement at both ends, was badly crushed and partly disrupted along one of the great torso furrows. Results, quickly reported over the wireless, were baffling and provocative indeed. Nothing like delicacy or accuracy was possible with instruments hardly able to cut the anomalous tissue, but the little that was achieved left us wholly awed and bewildered. Existing biology would have to be wholly revised, for this thing was no product of any cell growth science knows about. There had been scarcely any mineral replacement, and despite an age of perhaps 40 million years, the internal organs were wholly intact. The leathery, undeteriorative, and almost indestructible quality was an inherent attribute of the thing's form of organization, and pertained to some Pelagian cycle of invertebrate evolution utterly beyond the powers of speculation. At first, all that Lake found was dry, but as the heated temp produced its thawing effect, organic moisture of pungent and offensive odor was encountered towards the thing's uninjured side. It was not blood, but a thick, dark green fluid, apparently answering the same purpose. By the time Lake reached this stage, all 37 dogs had been brought to the still uncompleted corral near the camp, and even at the distance set up a savage barking and show of restlessness at the acrid, diffusive smell. Far from helping to place this strange entity, this provisional dissection merely deepened its mystery. All guesses about its external members had been correct, and on the evidence of these one could hardly hesitate to call the thing animal. But internal inspection brought up so many vegetable evidences that Lake was left hopelessly at sea. It had digestion and circulation, and eliminated waste matter through the reddish tubes of its starfish-shaped base. Curiously, one would say that its respiration apparatus handled oxygen rather than carbon dioxide, and there were odd evidences of air storage chambers and methods of shifting respiration from the external orifice to at least 2 other fully developed breathing systems, gills and pores. Clearly it was amphibian, and probably adopted to long airless hibernation periods as well. Vocal organs seemed to present in connection with the main respiratory system, but they presented anomalies beyond immediate solution. Articulate speech in the sense of syllable utterance seemed barely conceivable, but musical piping notes covering a wide range were highly probable. The muscular system was almost prematurely developed. The nervous system was so complex and highly developed as to leave Lake aghast. Though excessively primitive and archaic in some respects, the thing had a set of ganglia centres and connections arguing the very extremes of specialised development. Its 5-lobed brain was surprisingly advanced, and there were signs of a sensory equipment developed in part through the wiry cilia of the head, involving factors alien to any other terrestrial organism. Probably it has more than 5 senses, so that its habits could not be predicted from any existing analogy. It must, Lake thought, have been a creature of keen sensitiveness and delicately differentiated functions in its primal world, much like the ants and bees of today. It reproduced like the vegetable cryptogams, especially the Pteridophyta, having spore cases at the tips of the wings and evidently developing from a thallus or prothallus. But to give it a name at this stage was mere folly. It looked like a radiate, but was clearly something more. It was partly vegetable, but had 3/4 of the essential of animal structure. That it was marine in origin, its symmetrical contour and certain other attributes clearly indicated, yet one could not be exact as to the limit of its later adaptions. The wings, after all, had a persistent suggestion of the aerial. How it could have undergone its tremendously complex evolution on a newborn Earth, in time to leave prints in Archean rocks, was so far beyond conception as to make Lake whimsically recall the primal myths about the great old ones, who filtered down from the stars and concocted Earth life as a joke or mistake, and the wild tales of cosmic hill things from outside told by a folklorist colleague in Miskatonic's English department. Naturally, he considered the possibility of the Precambrian prints having been made by a less evolved ancestor to the present specimens, but quickly rejected this too facile theory upon considering the advanced structural qualities of the older fossils. If anything, the later contours showed decadence rather than higher evolution. The size of the pseudofeet had decreased, and the whole morphology seemed coarsened and simplified. Moreover, the nerves and organs just examined held singular suggestions of retrogression from forms still more complex. Atrophied and vestigial parts were surprisingly prevalent. Altogether, little could be said to have been solved, and Lake fell back on mythology for a provisional name, jocosely dubbing his finds the Elder Ones. At about 2:30 a.m., having decided to postpone further work and get a little rest, he covered the dissected organism with a tarpaulin, emerged from the laboratory tent, and studied the intact specimens with renewed interest. The ceaseless Antarctic sun had begun to limber up their tissues a trifle, so that the head points and tubes of two or three showed signs of unfolding, but Lake did not believe there was any danger of immediate decomposition in the almost sub-zero air. He did, however, move all the undissected specimens close together and throw a spare tent over them in order to keep off the direct solar rays. That would also help to keep their possible scent away from the dogs, whose hostile unrest was really becoming a problem even at their increased distance and behind the higher and higher snow walls which an increased quota of the men were hastening to raise around their quarters. He had to weight down the corners of the tent cloth with heavy blocks of snow to hold it in place amidst the rising gale, for the Titan Mountains seemed about to deliver some gravely severe blasts. Early apprehensions about sudden Antarctic winds were revived, and under Atwood's supervision, precautions were taken to bank the tents, new dog corral, and crude aeroplane shelters with snow on the mountainward side. These latter shelters, begun with hard snow blocks during the odd moments, were by no means as high as they should have been, and Lake finally detached all hands from other tasks to work on them. It was after 4 when Lake at last prepared to sign off and advised us all to share the rest period his outfit would take when the shelter walls were a little higher. He held some friendly chat with Parbody over the ether and repeated his praise of the really marvellous drills that had helped him make his discovery. Atwood also sent greetings and praises. I gave Lake a warm word of congratulations, owning up that he was right about the western trip, and we then all agreed to get in touch by wireless at 10 in the morning. If the gale was over then, Lake would send a plane for the party at my base. Just before retiring, I dispatched a final message to the Arkham with instructions about toning down the day's news for the outside world, since the full detail seemed radical enough to arouse a wave of incredulity until further substantiated. Well, there you go. I'm still looking for story submissions, so if you've written anything Lovecraftian or creepy or scary, please get in touch. Submission guidelines can be found on the website at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. That's all for today, except to remind you that the opening music was by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.
This was my first word of the discovery, and it told of the identification of early shells, bones, of ganoids and placoderms, remnants of labyrinthodons, and the theodoc... This was my first word of the discovery, and it told of the identification of early shells, bones of ganoids and placoderms, remnants of labyrinthodonts, great mosasaur skull fragments, dinosaur vertebrae and armor plates, pterodactyl teeth and wing bones, archaeopteryx debris.
I'm never gonna read it.
This was my first word of the discovery, and it told of the identification of early shells, bones of ganoids and placoderms, remnants of labyrinthodonts and thecodonts, great mosasaur skull fragments, dinosaur vertebrae and armor plates, pterodactyl teeth and wing bones, archaeopteryx debris, Miocene shark's teeth, primitive bird skulls, and other bones of the archaic mammals, such as Plesiotherus. Such as Paleotheres, Xiphodons, Eophilae, Iriodons, and Titanotheres. This was my first word of the discovery, and it told of the identification of early shells, bones of ganoids and placoderms, remnants of lithernodonts, the labyrinthodonts. This was my first word of the discovery, and it told of the identification of early shells, bones of ganoids and placoderms, remnants of the labyrinthodonts, the thecodonts, great mosasaur skull fragments, dinosaur vertebrae and armor plates, pterodactyl teeth, wing bones, archaeopteryx debris, Miocene shark's teeth, primitive bird skulls, and other bones of archaic mammals such as Paleotheres, Xiphodons, Eophippi, Eridons, Titanotheres. There was nothing as recent as a mastodon elephant, true camel, deer, bovine animal. Hence, Lake concluded that the last deposits had occurred before the...